And tonight on Coast to Coast, we're going to talk about mind power. Dr. Joe Dispenza joins us, breaking the habit of being yourself, how to lose your mind and create a new one. We'll get ready for that. We'll be back with Dr. Joe in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Joe Dispenza studied biochemistry at Rutgers University. He holds a Bachelor of Science degree with an emphasis in neuroscience as well. He received his postgraduate training and continuing education in neurology, brain function, chemistry, aging, longevity. Dr. Joe educates people about the functions of the human brain, and he has taught thousands, literally thousands, how to reprogram their thinking. Fascinating new work here called Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. Tonight, our special guest, Dr. Joe Dispenza. Joe, how are you?
Very good, George. Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
Me too. I'm looking forward to this. You know, the brain has so many different abilities. You know, to me, it's like the computer of the body. And people always say, Joe, that, you know, we only use 10% of our brain. How do they know that?
Well, that was a myth that was probably created about 25 years ago. The reason being is because we have part of our brain called the neocortex, which is our thinking brain. And it's made up of gray matter called nerve cells. And then underneath it is another part of the brain that's made of white matter. And there's about 10 times to 9 times amount of white matter compared to gray matter. So the mathematics was simple. Well, if there's, you know, if there's a certain percentage of gray matter and then 9 times the amount of white matter, we would say, well, that white matter isn't as functional. That doesn't process thought. So the myth said, well, we use about a tenth of our brain. And so that isn't actually the truth. But if you look at functional brain scans, when you look at people, when you study a brain in action, when you study the brain in action, that's called mind, we can see that the brain doesn't work in such, you know, coherent fashions. We don't use, you know, all the brain at once.
Would you say, Joe, that if the brain was used all at once, that it might have a bigger capacity than a computer?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We haven't even tapped
amazing
potential.
That is truly amazing, isn't it, when you think of that?
Yeah, you know, well, the amazing thing about mind, and mind is the brain in action, or mind is the brain at work. If you have 100 billion neurons that make up the brain and they're seamlessly pieced together, and mind is the brain in action, that means we can make the brain work in different sequences, different patterns, and different combinations. And if you have 100 billion neurons, we should be able to make the brain work in many different patterns. So we're just beginning to step outside the box of what's possible.
Joe, when somebody injures their brain and they, you know, put them through a brain scan, and they're able to say, all right, you've got damage here or this. How do they know that? How does that show up on these scans?
Well, when you study functional imagery, and this is what has taken brain science to the next level. 25 or 30 years ago, if you had an injury to your brain, the common procedure was they did a CAT scan or an MRI. They took a snapshot of your brain. And the snapshot basically tells you that there's broken parts or missing pieces or damaged areas. A functional brain scan is like a motion picture of the brain. And when you see that brain moving in different patterns and sequences and certain areas lit up and other areas cooled down or shut off, you know that area is not functioning properly or it's working too hard. So the motion picture of the brain tells us so much information because now we can look at the trends and patterns. For example, there's many different types of ADD. You can see when a person's functionally aggressive, or when you see when someone's holding on to a problem, or you can see when there's anxiety or depression, or if certain areas are working too hard. So functional imagery is taking brain science to the next level.
You talk about in Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, how to lose your mind and create a new one. Tell me about that headline just all by itself, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. What does that mean?
Well, by the time we're 35 years old, the psychological and neuroscientific model says that by the time we're 35 years old, we've memorized a set of behaviors, emotional reactions, and thought patterns that have become part of our identity. And that if 95% of who we are by the time we're 35 is a memorized set of programs, then the greatest habit we have to break is the habit of being ourselves.
All right, let's get into some of these areas that you talk about change, and you say that there are three areas. Let's go through them if you could explain that, Joe.
Sure. Well, the most common thing, let's just say that we make the assumption that the way you think has something to do with your life, or the way you think has something to do with your destiny. Well, the first thing that we have to do is we have to overcome our most present familiar environment, our familiar life. So if you wake up in the morning and you get out of bed and you shut the alarm clock off with the same finger that you did yesterday, if you know, you slip into your favorite slippers, you walk into the bathroom, you use the toilet like you always do, then you look in the mirror to remember who you are, and you wash yourself off the same way as you always do, and then you drink coffee out of your favorite mug, and then you go to work by driving in the same route that you did yesterday. You see the same people that push the same emotional buttons. You do the same things that you've memorized and you can do so well. And you hurry up and go home so you can hurry up and check your email so you can hurry up and do it all over again. You know, it begs the question, did your brain change at all that day? We could say that you were thinking the same thoughts, performing the same actions, living by the same emotional states, and secretly expecting something different to happen in your life. So neuroscience says that your brain is organized to reflect everything you know in your life. Your brain is a record of your environment. So as you see the same people and you go to the same places and you do the same things at the same time, it's the external environment that's turning on different circuits in your brain, causing you to think equal to everything that you know, react unconsciously to everything familiar in your life. And as long as you keep turning on the same circuits in the same way as you recognize the same thing, the principle in neuroscience says that nerve cells that fire together, wire together. We begin to hardwire our brains into very specific patterns that reflect our external world. So to change then is to think greater than the environment, to think greater than the conditions in your life. And I think every great person in history understood this, whether it was William Wallace or Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King, Joan of Arc, Queen Elizabeth I, they all had a vision. They all had an idea. And they were so passionate about that idea that they couldn't live any other way. So it begs the question, can you believe in a future that you can't see or experience with your senses yet, but you've thought about enough times in your mind that your brain has literally changed to look like that event has already happened? Now, the neuroscientific model of reality says it's absolutely possible that we can change our brains just by thinking differently. And to change, then, is to overcome the present associations in your life to begin to think and act greater than those conditions.
Okay, I would agree with that. I would agree with that entirely. Some of the other areas that people, is meditation a lot of this?
Well, you know, my interest has always been in demystifying the mystical. I think this is a time in history where people not only want to know, but they want to know how. And so the word meditation literally means to become familiar with, to make known. The symbol in ancient Tibetan means to become familiar with. Now, because of the size of our frontal lobe, that's the crowning achievement of the human being. It's 40% of our entire brain. That's what separates us from all other species. You know, the next closest species, primates and gibbons, about 14 to 17%. Dogs are about 7%. And for cats, it's about 3.5%. Now, the frontal lobe is where we begin to pay attention or become conscious of who we are. That concept in neuroscience is called metacognition. The fact that we can observe our thoughts, we can pay attention to our behaviors, we can notice how we feel. It means that we could modify our behaviors to do a better job in life. So the word meditation then, to become familiar with, if you're noticing your unconscious thoughts because you've closed your eyes and eliminated the environment, you've become aware of your unconscious habits or behaviors, and you begin to feel your emotions that are typically driving you to the same state. The fact that you're beginning to observe them means now you're no longer the program, but you're the consciousness observing the program. So the first step in meditation, then, is the unlearning process. It's to become aware of the old self, the aspects of ourselves that we want to change, to go into the operating system of those subconscious programs and bring them to our conscious awareness so that we have dominion over them and a better ability to change them. Now, The second part of meditation, if we look at the word to become familiar with again, means then, as we begin to think of new ways of being, as we begin to speculate new possibilities, that frontal lobe turns on again, and it's like a great symphony leader. It looks out over the landscape of the entire brain, and if we said, well, what is compassion, or what is joy, or what is freedom? Well, it begins to assemble all these different networks of neurons, and it combines them in different patterns. Whenever we begin to make the brain work differently, now we're changing the mind. And so in the first step, we're unfiring and unwiring those neurons, and then we begin to biologically prune away the old self. As we begin to think about new ways of being and speculate possibilities, we begin to fire and wire new sequences and new patterns, and we begin to install the neurological hardware. And if we practice that every day, we begin to become familiar with a new self, and that becomes the very platform of our identity.
Joe, there's an old saying, of course, leopards don't change their spots. I've always believed that if one is an alcoholic, he or she will always be an alcoholic. They may not drink, they may be able to control themselves, but they're still alcoholics. If somebody's a child abuser, they're still pedophiles. They may, through therapy, stop doing what they've done, but I still think they're pedophiles. Is that true? Can people change or not?
According to the neuroscientific model, this principle that we call neuroplasticity says that we're changed by every thought we think, every behavior or choice that we make that's different than the past, every dream that we speculate, every vision that we have. Our brain literally reorganizes itself to reflect a new level of mind. So given the right learning and the right instruction and the right feedback from the neuroplastic model, people can evolve out of an old self and literally re-enter into a new self. The key is to be able to sustain that change independent of the environment, which of course causes us to return back to the old self.
I was going to say, you don't think though that people generally will drift back to whatever they were doing before?
You know, it's kind of a funny concept, but your body is your greatest mind reader in the world. Your body is precognitive. And so most of the time, you know, when we make a decision to change, you know, if you were sitting down and 9 out of 10 times you said to yourself, I'm going to fake standing up, what one time out of those 10 times I'm actually going to stand up? Well, before you even made the conscious decision to stand up, your adrenal glands would squirt out a certain amount of adrenaline to keep the same volume of blood going to your brain. In other words, your body was ahead of your conscious mind. Now, when most people make a decision to change, you know, they're typically sitting on a couch, they have the remote control in their hand, they have their computer to the right, they have their smartphone to the left, and they say, yeah, I think I'm going to change tomorrow. And so the body, as the unconscious mind, doesn't get the signal the person is really going to make any significant change. The body already knows that that person's not coming out of their resting state to change. But if you ever said to yourself, I'm going to do this, and you say, I don't care what's going on in my life, that's the environment. I don't care how I feel, that's your body. I don't care how long it takes, that's time. I'm going to do this, and the hair on the back of your neck stands up. The body gets a very strong signal, and that type of signal begins to rewrite those programs.
Now, that takes training, though, doesn't it?
Absolutely. It takes, or it's kind of a funny condition, but we really change in one of two states. Most people, and this is the human condition, wait for crisis or trauma or disease or diagnosis or loss to get about the business of change. Now, we reach our lowest denominator, and all of a sudden we start to get serious and we begin to examine who we're being. Or, you know, we can learn and change in a state of pain and suffering, or we can learn and change in a state of joy and inspiration. I think my message is, why wait? Why wait till we reach the lowest denominator before we make that decision? So when we reach that lowest point, we get serious enough where we can't go on being the same person any longer. And when we reach that point, you know, it's kind of a human condition. That's when we really say, okay, Let me look at the thoughts I no longer want to believe in about myself or my life, and let me begin to examine my habits and behavior that undermining my efforts or my goals, and let me look at these emotions that aren't loving to myself, and let me choose something else. We can do that, you know, with the training to understand.
One of the things, for example, Joe, that I have a difficult time grasping, for example, New Year's resolutions. I mean, we come up to the new year, and people try to set goals and objectives for themselves, whether it's a better job or to lose weight or a better relationship. But they always tend to put it off until New Year. They make that resolution. I'm going to lose 35 pounds in the new year. Why don't they just do it right then?
Well, this is the reason I wrote Breaking the Habit. And then this is the biggest reason why it's so hard to change, because we start out with really good intentions. We make a declaration. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to be healthy. You know, I'm going to exercise. And then 2 hours later, most people are sitting on a couch and they're watching their favorite
eating television. A pizza.
Eating the pizza and eating ice cream, and they've gone unconscious.
Which is not an idea, bad idea later, but go ahead.
Well, if we examine this, let's take a look at this, because we said 95% of who we are by the time we're 35 years old is a set of unconscious thoughts, behaviors, and emotions or emotional reactions that are literally happening behind the scenes of our awareness. So if that's 95% of who we are, people, to give you an example, a great example that I like to use is, you know, if you grab the telephone, and you'd have to be over 35 for this, but if you couldn't consciously remember a phone number and you walked over to the receiver and you looked at the receiver, the moment you looked at the receiver, you would be able to dial that phone number. You couldn't consciously remember it, but your body practiced it so many times that it knew better than your brain.
It just knows what to do.
That's called a procedural memory, and that's a great example of a subconscious program. So we have all these subconscious programs. So then the moment we see some person, or we go to our favorite place, or we start doing the same things, we begin to go unconscious. So that's one of the reasons why it's important to get beyond the operating system of the conscious mind and enter into the subconscious operating system to make those changes. In other words, but most people are trying to use 5% of their conscious mind to work against 95% of what they've memorized subconsciously. So they plan a new life consciously, but they feel unworthy. That's mind and body in opposition. They begin to think about being wealthy, but they feel poor. And so we have to begin to understand that there's a science that says we can begin to change the brain and body ahead of the environment, and that's what Breaking the Habit is about.
What is it, Joe, about the body that makes you move, for example, your arm? Before you move your arm, you think about it. There's that little voice in your head that goes, move your arm, and you move your arm or move your leg or stand up, as you were saying, or sit down. What is it in the brain? What is the brain talking to have you move that arm?
Well, who is that little voice anyway?
And who is that little voice? That's right.
Well, when we start out doing something, we start out unconsciously unskilled, which means we don't even know that we don't even know. As we begin to practice something or we begin to learn new things, we become consciously unskilled. Now we know that we don't know how to do it. If we keep persisting and we keep doing something over and over again, we begin to become consciously skilled. But the final step is that if we keep practicing something repeatedly over and over again through experience, we become unconsciously skilled, which means we've done it so many times that we begin to memorize that action.
Like swinging a baseball bat. Joe, we're going to hit this break. I want to come back and we'll talk to you in just a moment. Dr. Joe Dispenza's website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And we'll be right back as we talk about his work, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And our very special guest tonight, Dr. Joe Dispenza, as we talk about the power of the mind. Fascinating, truly fascinating indeed. So, Joe, like a great baseball player, they've got, you know, incredible rhythm. What makes one ball player better than another?
You're asking me the hard questions, huh?
Yeah, I'm starting early with them, too.
Okay. Well, let me explain a concept that we're just beginning to understand from a neuroscientific model. And we actually have three brains. And those three brains allow us to go from thinking to doing to being.
Sometimes I've met people that didn't have any brains, Joe.
Well, we come with three brains in one. And the first brain is the neocortex. That's that walnut-covered brain that has all the folds and bumps and valleys. And that is the seat of your conscious awareness. And that every time you learn something new, you make a new connection in your thinking brain. That's what learning is. Learning is forging new connections. Remembering is maintaining and sustaining those connections. So you read the book on how to hit a baseball. You read a book on how to ride a bicycle. You read a book on how to dance the salsa. You read a book on how to cook Mandarin cuisine. You read a book on compassion or forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that information is stored in your thinking brain. Now, as you review that information, as you repeat it, as you begin to contemplate on it, you're reinforcing those circuits, and repetition and our volition, repeating it, begins to fire and wire those circuits in your thinking brain. So it's philosophy, it's theory, it's intellectual data, it's facts, it's knowledge. Now, when you take what you learn intellectually and you apply it or you personalize it or you demonstrate it, it means now you're going to have to modify your behavior in some way, change your actions. And when you do that, you have a new experience. So now, in the midst of an experience, everything you're seeing and smelling and tasting and feeling and hearing, all of your five senses are immersed into the external environment. And as your brain is beginning to gather all of this sensory data, all that information is rushing back to your brain, and jungles of neurons are beginning to organize themselves into patterns. The moment those neurons string into place, they release a chemical, and that chemical is called a feeling or an emotion. When that happens, we activate the second brain, called the limbic brain, or the emotional brain, or the chemical brain. So, you read the book on forgiveness, and you have all this information stored in your thinking brain, or you read the book on how to hit a baseball. Now, all of that information you have to do something with. Now, when you get your behaviors to match your intentions, or you get your actions equal to your thoughts, or you get your body involved in some way, when you actually change your actions, that experience begins to reinforce the circuits in your brain neurologically, and it begins to chemically condition or chemically instruct your body to teach it what your mind is intellectually understood.
All right, but I may get this book on how to play the piano, and I may read it cover to cover three times. I still may never be a great piano player, Joe.
True. Well, there's a couple ingredients that allow us to get to that point. One of it is attention. And when we pay attention to what we're doing, attention is one of the key elements that allows us to begin to unify mind and body. So if a person can't restrain their impulsive habits and behaviors and begin to get their body to respond in different ways, if they can't get that alignment working, more than likely they won't be able to develop a skill. But let's just say, though, that a person continues to practice through repetition. They keep doing something over and over again. If we keep doing something and re-experiencing the same event, we begin to neurochemically condition the body to memorize that behavior as well as the conscious mind. And whenever the mind and body are working together, now we're in a state of being, and we activate that third brain called the cerebellum. That's the seat of the subconscious. That's where we've practiced something so many times, we don't have to think about it any longer. So when it gets to that point, it begins to become innate. It begins to become subconscious. It begins to become automatic. And so the skill that we develop from practicing anything requires attention. It requires learning. It requires the proper instruction. And it requires repetition. Now, some people can relax into it a little easier than others. But those ingredients, if we keep doing it enough times, will begin to assemble mind and body to work together.
Fascinating how this all works. Who in the heck thought of this?
A lot of people sitting around asking the question, how does this work?
Are you particularly spiritual? Do you believe in a divine creator? I ask you that Because, you know, to me, you're a scientist right now, and I'd love to get your views on whether you think this all had some design behind it.
Well, I consider myself a spiritual person because when you begin to study science and you begin to look at the nature of reality, if you're not fascinated by the fact that, you know, our heart beats over 2 gallons of blood in a minute over a, you know, 200 gallons of blood in an hour over, you know, 100,000 times in one day through 60,000 miles of blood vessels. And, you know, we lose 10 million cells every second and we make 10 million cells the next second. Or that in one cell, it goes through the order of 100,000 chemical reactions in 1 second. If we don't begin to look at something that's giving us life, some intelligence that's organizing these functions, I think we go from a very we start to reduce life down to a very mechanistic model. And I think the more that I learn and the more that I study, the more I begin to realize that that's not how things really are. And you know, with the advent of quantum physics and the understanding that there is the subjective mind has some effect on our objective world, starts to give us permission to become empowered and to begin to take control of our destiny.
Joe, does the abnormal mind create different kinds of people? And by that I mean whether they become serial killers or geniuses like an Albert Einstein. Does an abnormal brain, and to me that is a brain outside the normal function of a regular type brain, does that create those kinds of people?
Are you saying that are you asking if the brain creates a personality?
Yeah. I mean, would a brain that just would not be considered normal, and I don't know what you would consider normal to be, but if somebody said, if a doctor said, you know, he has an abnormal brain, if he was born that way, for example, there have been some cases where, you know, they have said that these people have become serial killers. Something's wrong with them.
Sure.
What is it in the brain that has caused these people to do such heinous acts?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, George. We could say that, first of all, if you look at so many functional brain scans that I've actually had the privilege of looking at, there's not many normal brains out there. There tends to be more abnormal, which is
really
normal. Yeah. And one of the biggest reasons for that is the stress. And when we live responding and reacting to our environment so often, and we keep knocking the brain and body out of balance, that, you know, that imbalance becomes the new balance, and then we start heading for some type of disease or malady, you know, mentally in mental health or physically in our body. But someone who's born with a chemical imbalance in their brain, or they've had a head injury early in life, or they've had...
Or a deformity.
A deformity, or even, you know, which is probably the most common, early childhood traumas where they have been abused or exposed to some difficult conditions repeatedly. In that case, the brain adapts in certain ways so the person can continue to function in the world. And whenever they experience the same or similar condition emotionally, they regress back to that person again. So, you know, whether it's created genetically, you know, or it's created by the environment, when there's an imbalance in the brain, when there's some type of chemical or neurological or anatomical imbalance in the brain, you know, when the brain doesn't work right, we don't work right. And so, you know, again, with the understanding of what looking at mind and functional scans, this is where brain science is beginning to become more of a science, a hard science instead of a soft science. You know, again, you know, if you have a problem with your heart, for the most part, you go to the doctor and he or she does a scan of your heart. If you have a gallbladder problem, you get an ultrasound of your gallbladder. Well, now, you know, if you have a problem with your brain, for the most part, most people go to the doctor and you're given a pharmaceutical and, you know, it sounds something like this. Well, try this out and see how you do and let's see if this helps you. And then you go home and you say, God, you know, I've lost my libido, I'm not hungry, and I can't sleep at night. And the doctor may say, well, take more, or they'll say, oh, that's not the right medication. Try this medication. Now, that's guesswork. Now, because of functional imagery, can actually scan the brain, and we could say, that's not looking very good. And then we can try a pharmaceutical. We could even try nutritional supplements. We can try certain therapies. And then we can rescan the brain, and we can say, now that person looks better. Yeah, their brain is not working so hard, or that the brain is moving more towards balance. And no longer is it a subjective feedback, but now it's becoming more objective science.
You've talked about meditation on the program before, earlier, but different people would have different views on what meditation is, Joe, and yours is not like most. Tell me about that.
Well, I always say that if you get up from your meditation as the same person who sat down, nothing's really happened to you neurologically, biologically, genetically, or epigenetically. Nothing's happened to you in terms of change. I mean, we have to get up, and we have to feel differently than when we sat down. And if we begin to look at some of the latest research in studying brainwave patterns, and a lot of the research being done at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but we have different types of brainwaves. I mean, we're talking right now and we're interacting, and for the most part, our brainwaves are in what's called beta brainwave patterns. That's thinking brainwave patterns. That's our analytical mind. We need that beta pattern to be able to navigate in our external world. And in beta, because of the patterns that are created, we're perking up our neocortex, and we're trying to create meaning between the outer world and the inner world. That's really the mechanism of the brain, to create coherence or meaning between what's going outside of us, going on outside of us, and what's going on inside of us. So when we're functioning in reality, we're producing beta wave patterns. Now, when you close your eyes and you begin to eliminate the external environment and you begin to, you know, reduce the amount of sensory information that's coming to your brain, your brainwave patterns begin to slow down into what's called alpha brainwaves. Now, in alpha, the inner world tends to be more real than the outer world. And children usually from the ages of 0 to 7 or 10 usually are functioning normally in alpha. And that's why you can tell a child to act like a rabbit at 9 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, she's still hopping around in the kitchen, because the imaginary world is that real. If we begin to relax the body a little bit more, like when you're going to sleep and you begin to fall into a light sleep where the body begins to fall asleep and the mind is awake, that's called theta. Now, this is what I call magic land, because I said that a habit is when the body becomes the mind. So if we've put the body to sleep and it's no longer the mind, this is where change can happen the quickest. Now, delta is deep sleep. That's when the person's in a restorative state, and that's pretty much when they're unconscious. There's very little active conscious functioning in their neocortex. Now, most people move up and down the scale when they go to bed at night. They're going from beta to alpha to theta to delta. And when they wake up in the morning, because of brain chemistry, they're going from delta to theta to alpha to beta. Now, what the whole purpose of meditation is, to get beyond the analytical mind and begin to move into the operating system of the subconscious mind, where all of those programs exist.
Is it kind of like trying to break down a layer or some kind of a shell?
It's kind of, you know, so it's about slowing down your thinking brain. Now, here's most people's problems. Most people try to analyze their problems within the emotions that they're living by. And emotions are literally a record of your past experiences. So the solution is outside of that emotion, beyond your analysis. So most people, as they begin to analyze their problems, they drive their brain more into that higher beta pattern, and it moves them separate from the operating system to make the change. So when we begin to do our meditation, according to the latest research, there's absolute ways that we can begin to slow brainwave patterns down, to begin to move from the conscious mind into the subconscious mind to make those changes. And the type of brainwave patterns that seems to be the hot topic in neuroscience right now is what's called coherent brainwave patterns. Now, coherence is when, you know, everything is operating in rhythm, when there's orderliness, a rhythm, when there's synchrony, when everything's beginning to work together. And when the brainwave patterns move into that orderliness or that synchrony, It's a very specific way that the brain begins to work in a holistic fashion. And different compartments of the brain that were no longer communicating with each other because of the hormones of stress all of a sudden move into balance, and they begin to hold hands, and we begin to experience more wholeness or more orderliness, that we feel more like ourselves than we have in a long time. And that's that meditative state where we begin to relax and we begin to feel so good that we're no longer being affected by the external world. Now, this is the beauty, because if you practice this type of coherence and you begin to create this orderliness, the research shows that when the incoherence of your external environment no longer knocks you out of balance, because you've memorized such a state of orderliness and coherence. So I use science pretty much as the model to begin to demystify meditation. And people who actually practice it and do it, it's a skill, just like golf or tennis. The more you practice it and the more you're able to remove yourself beyond your identity, that's when with the brain and body happens to recalibrate and move back to order.
Let me ask you about people who generally are intuitive. Do they have different kind of brain functions in order to do that?
They actually do. Most people who are intuitive don't analyze with their thinking neocortex. They tend to slow that thinking part of their brain down, and they trust, for the most part, imagery or a stream of consciousness that is beyond their critical analytical mind, because the moment they start to rationalize what they're doing, they move out of the part of the brain where they actually have that skill. So, and the answer to the question is absolutely yes. They slow down their thinking brain in order to pick up information.
That is remarkable all by itself, isn't it?
It is, and that's a great example of quantum physics and non-locality. I mean, the fact that our awareness is so mobile, and that's really the privilege of being a human being. You know, we can unfold the past bitter memory that's tattooed in the recesses of our gray matter, and in a moment it comes to life, and in that moment it's real to us. Or we can begin to forecast some worst-case scenario that's going to happen in our future, and we can obsess about it to the exclusion of everything else, so that the body begins to subconsciously or physiologically change as if it's in that future event in the moment. So if that's the case, can we begin to mobilize our awareness outside of time and space, and to begin to pick up information that exists outside of linear time?
Joe, what makes some people more successful than other people? Not necessarily in just money, but they're generally more successful in life.
Well, I think I have to step outside the neuroscientific model, and I think that one of the key components really is that when people get clear on a vision or a purpose, we call that duty motivation or purpose motivation. They begin to get clear on a mission for themselves, and when they get clear on this type of long-term vision instead of a short-term goal, and that vision takes them out of their resting state, they begin to see the outcome without any obstacles, and they review that mission for themselves. And usually the purpose or the mission is bigger than themselves. It's not just localized to making money, but it's something that they're contributing in a selfless way to the whole. People who have that type of vision and review that vision enough times is usually the people who get their behaviors to match their intentions. And when we hit adversity in our life or we hit obstacles, the next thing is adaptability, our ability to change and to learn what just happened and take another route or begin to change our actions in some way.
Joe, we're going to talk about how to change when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM.